Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
This is The Guardian.
We laugh at the idea of cookers and people that are sort of sitting there online in their underpants trying to create their own reality. But it's actually all of us. It's just some of us get hung up into particular conspiracy theories or particular wormholes, and the rest of us just feel overwhelmed.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Chief Political Correspondent at Guardian Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Today, my guest is Peter Lewis, the Executive Director of Essential Media, and we're talking about the latest Guardian Essential poll. Welcome, Peter.
Hey, Paul.
Now, there were some warning signs in this poll for Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. We'll talk a little later about the two-party preferred and the leader, but there were a lot of interesting findings about faith in democracy, electoral reform, and trust in online information. So perhaps we could start with trust in democracy. How do people think it's all going?
Yeah, it feels like we've done a little bit of a structural take of our body politic this week, a little trip to the GP, as it were, or the grand pollster, as I like to think of myself. And one of the questions we asked was, are you satisfied or dissatisfied with the way democracy is working in Australia? And we've kind of got, 32 satisfied, 31 dissatisfied, and another third neither satisfied nor dissatisfied. And one of the really interesting charts, if people want to play at home at essentialreport.com.au, is the trend line on this, because we asked this in November 17, we asked it in May 2022, we've asked it in March 24. And the graph looks like a pair of lips in that in November 17, we were pretty much at the same point, 35-32. And then May 2022, which was straight after the federal election, I'm going to say, it was 47-19 in a positive. And now we've gone back to kind of where we were in November 17. So I'm not quite sure what the signal and the noise is there. Obviously, one of the things we've been speaking about really since Christmas is that a lot of the analysis and the numbers can be read through the prism of financial pressure. As we were saying last week, we've got half the electorate saying they're either in serious financial difficulty or struggling to get by. But that dissatisfaction level is high, and it's not a great number for both of the major political parties in particular, who are seen as being sort of stables of our democratic system. And it seems like there is a lot of oxygen for outsiders, which is a bit of a theme that we might go through a bit later as we get into some of the other numbers as well.
Yeah, I always get suspicious of results that shake out about a third, a third, a third, because it seems like, you know, people can't make up their minds, so they split evenly across all the options. But yeah,
but it's not one person splitting a third, a third, a third. It's the entire population, Paul.
No, but I really think that the fact that there is such a big movement between May 2022 and the midterm blues, yeah. it does feel substantially different. Not like people are splitting the difference.
So Labor voters satisfied with democracy at 44, Coalition at 35, Greens at 27, and people who vote independent or another party at just 19. So maybe it is the blues, but, you know, that line. Like, so sometimes we say, oh, it goes up when if your side wins, and I don't think people are that tied to one side as they were, there's a small cohort that are still like cheering one side of politics. But this sort of shows, across the field, there's a graduation in the way they are dissociated from the process.
And there was some debate last week about a suite of electoral reforms. We're expecting the government to try and introduce spending and donation caps and truth in political advertising. And the independents had their own bill for a mega donation cap. You couldn't donate more than $1.5 million across the entire electoral cycle. So you've put some of these sub-propositions to people. What did people think would improve democracy?
So broad support for changes. I would say that a lot of the time with these reforms, the devil is in the detail, and it's hard to put the detail into a sensible question. But on the broad propositions, ensure that content of political adverts must be truthful. 72% support, only 8% opposed. Now, who wouldn't support truth in advertising? I guess the point there is, what is the mechanism to achieve that? And I think, you know, what's being proposed is only a process for the most egregious, like Dex death tax or Mediscare. It's not about arguing the toss on small bits, but in a world, and as we'll talk about later, if an ecosystem that's got less of an anchor around truth, that's interesting that people are looking for a bit of an anchor there legislatively. 37, strong support, 27, mild support. That's on my dodgy numbers, 64% all up support for real-time reporting of donations to political parties. At the moment, it's not till after the election that you find out who is putting their money behind a particular party. And similar levels of support, 61% for placing caps on the value of donations companies or individuals can give to political parties. Again, there's always argy-bargy between different parties. So while the coalition will push back on companies and individuals, they'll say Labor shouldn't take money from unions. And then you've got the outsider parties, particularly the Teals and Palmer United, that take large sums from individuals. So again, how that plays out will be significant. But again, I think the thing that shines through is people want to see something done. They don't think that big donations should be dictating the outcome of elections. They want to know who's giving those big donations. They don't want people lying. The problem is, the bottom line is, and yeah, maybe it's more a problem for media companies actually than and digital platforms than political parties, but they don't want public funding to political candidates to reduce the reliance on donations. There's always been an argument the way you get money out of politics is to have the public fund candidates and fund parties to prosecute their cases. And we already do that. It would be about increasing the amount that occurs. At the moment, you get the funding after the election based on your results. So you kind of, there is an incentive in maximising your results, not just to empower, but also to recoup more of the funds you've spent. Smaller parties say that re-embeds the power of the major parties. But what this says is there's less. And again, it makes sense. Why would the public want to give money to political ads? They hate political ads. So, but all in all, wrapped up, I think the story here is there should be tighter guardrails on the way elections are conducted, and there's going to be appetite for the principles behind the laws without seeing what the specific detail is.
The surest way to take big private money out of politics is to put some public money in, but that's not quite as popular. So we'll see what people make on balance when they get a whole proposition from the government, not just these individual planks. Now, despite a concern about how democracy is going, there was actually a bit of optimism, a resurgence in how people are feeling climate change is being handled.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I think it's worth sort of delving into a little bit. So one of our benchmarks over many years has been and it's back to almost August 2016, we started asking this, which was simply, do you think Australia is doing enough, not enough, or too much to address climate change? At the beginning of this journey, 52% of us thought we weren't doing enough. just 22% enough. It peaked at 62% not doing enough in January 20, which I think there were certain bushfires and trips to Hawaii going on at about the same time, 19 not doing enough. And where we've landed this month is a bit of a keynote in that it is the first time that doing enough has exceeded not doing enough. And it's only 35, 34, but still. So 38% doing enough, 35% not doing enough, 18% doing too much, 10% don't know. How do we read this? I think we read it on one level. The government has set, probably for the first time in a decade, targets that sort of make sense to people to the extent people understand targets. But I also think because there is quite a bit of noise at the moment around the rollout of renewable energy projects, it actually sends the message that the government is doing something, which is different to not doing something. So the actual lived evidence that there are plans to build offshore wind and there are real solar farms being built and the grid is really being upgraded and there's real debates about the closures of gas and coal. I think all of that together is led to, you know, for the first time, like I say, since 2016, a perception that the government is doing something and more people think they're doing enough than not doing enough. What's really interesting, when you look at voting intention, the highest group that says the government is doing enough is actually coalition voters. And they might be saying, enough already, you're doing enough, 46. But that's more than Labor. So Labor is basically 40% doing enough, 40% not doing enough, basically no one saying doing too much. The coalition has a larger number saying that what's going on now is enough, whereas 67% of Greens say not doing enough, which is kind of on brand and hardly surprising.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'll get on to where people are getting their information in a minute, but I think we've eaten our greens now, and we can have some dessert, which is we do want to know about the two-party preferred and how the leaders are doing.
Yeah. So, what is the horse race? We've had a bit of an uptick in horse Dutton or horse coalition over horse Labor in the last little period. So we do a 2PP plus, which is basically we take the primary votes, we ask people to allocate preferences, and if they can't tell us, we leave them in as well. So we start with, you know, 6% of people undecided, so you kind of take them out, and then with them out, the coalition on our numbers has a majority of 50 to 44. So 50, 44, 6. In contrast, last week it was 48, 47, 5. So a little bit of fluctuation. You never read one poll too much. One of the great things about statistics is you can have noise in an individual poll, and the whole point is to pick up the movement over a period of time. But I do think it's also fair to say that since August 23, where the coalition's 2PP plus was 42, there has been a steady increase. And likewise, at the same time, Labor's 2PP plus was 52, there's been somewhat of a deterioration. I'm just seeing if there's anything else that strikes up. This is where you really get the demographic splits normally, but there you go, Labor and coalition under 34s are in the same kind of ballpark at the moment. And if oldies were over 55 determining the election, you would literally have a blue wave.
But it is volatile. I mean,
or a blue rinse, as I like to think of it.
You know, we noted that in February was the first time the coalition had overtaken in two-party preferred. If you took out the undecideds, that was sort of 51-49. It went back to 50-50 in early March, and now it's, if you take out the undecideds, it's 53-47. But again, it sort of bounces around. But the point is,
indeed, if we did everything we said we don't do in our poll, that's what you'd get.
But the leaders, the leaders' results are still pretty stable. Both Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton are on -3 net approval. If you know the people that gave them a positive score on a 10-point scale, there were 3 points fewer of them than people that gave them a negative score.
Yeah. Yeah, I once had a really good mate and we were both horrified when people mistook us each for each other's brother. Like, I feel like this is a bit the same. Like, Albo and Dutton are basically mirror images at the moment. I suspect they're both horrified to be in the same territory as the other one. So, but that's where they are, both of them, in terms of our, we give a 10-point rating, and in terms of negatives, they are both at 34. Neutrals, they're both around the 30, and positives, they're at the 31, or at least that is Mr. Dutton and Mr. Albanese is basically the same.
So not much difference there.
Mistaken for strangers.
Well, I want to ask, where are people getting their information? Are they suffering from information overload? Are we all finding things out in the same place or muddling through with different information?
So this is probably the anchoring piece this week. And look, you and I talk every fortnight and we try to sort of merge something bigger with what we think is going on politically. And I think this week we were thinking there was a few structural pieces, including the electoral reforms and also regulation of some of the platforms and the News Media Bargaining Code, which we may or may not get to. So I thought it was interesting in that context to think about how people as voters also process information. The one I was really interested in was this sense of being overwhelmed by the amount of information consumed online. So that was a statement we put to people. 35% agree with that, 30% disagree, and 35% kind of can neither agree nor disagree because they're so overwhelmed by the amount of information they consume online. But so you've got this world where a third of us are overwhelmed by information. We've also got a similar number, 35%, who say they actively avoid the news media. Then you've got even more than that, 48% saying they don't know which sources to believe. And then you've got a majority, 62%, who say, I question most facts by doing my own research. And on one level, that is very good digital citizenship. It is also the behaviour of those that we would class as cookers. So I was just interested in sort of drawing out these numbers, and particularly over different sort of ages and demographics, to sort of, I guess the thesis that I was trying to develop in the column this week was a bit, we laugh at the idea of cookers and people that are sort of sitting there online in their underpants trying to create their own reality. But it's actually all of us. It's just some of us get hung up into particular conspiracy theories or particular wormholes, and the rest of us just feel overwhelmed. And I've been reflecting on this when you think about the difficulty those at the centre of power have in engaging the community on big issues, because people are just literally, and I think this is true, we have never been exposed to so much information. I do think we're all basically cooking ourselves with too much of this stuff. And so part of the context for some of the reforms we talk about around truth in advertising or around platform reform or media reform is actually to create a healthy source of information and not something that's so ubiquitous that we're drowning in the noise.
And did you see a difference in terms of people's trust in democracy or their faith in how action on climate is going based on whether they did their own research or those points?
So there weren't statistically different... There wasn't statistically different findings with those crosstabs, but we also ran our quarterly online overtime focus group where we asked the same questions to a sample of 30 people in an online discussion board. And that's where it was really interesting. So people who said very confidently that they go and search out and find their own information were also those that were more likely to say that the system was corrupt, and that, you know, that you started seeing how all these things developed, that climate change was a plot by global financiers to make more money out of all of us. And so the way that I think we found correlation, if not causation, in some of the behaviours that you'd more characterise as conspiracy/cooker.
Maybe it's like Parliament. The closer you get to it, the more you dislike it. So it's like a radioactive material.
Yeah, except I think that there's something, and you really get it in what we call it, so we, these polls are like quant, they're numbers, and we try to make sense of it. The quad's really interesting because you either get people talking or you get people sort of typing in our discussion boards, and you really get a deeper feel for just how distant politics is from most people. So you can't have an active conspiracy theory where different players are being manipulated by different puppet masters if you're close to how the sausage is being made, because the sausage is actually made, like, again, there's lots of theories you can come up with about the way that democracy is made, but it is so far away from the theories that you get from people that are spending their time looking at it that you wonder, again, whether they're just drowning in all the detail.
Does social media make us happy?
Not really. I don't think we actually tested that. Do you think social media has a positive or negative impact on your life?
Maybe I've crudely...
Very positive. No, we do. Very positive 4%, somewhat positive 23%, so that's 27%, 29% negative or somewhat negative, 44% in the middle. The way you asked that question made me feel like it doesn't make you happy, Paul.
Well, I maybe crudely summarised it. Your positive or negative impact could be, you know, useful at finding bargains or, you know, something like that, whereas I was taking it in a more existential direction. I'm sorry.
Yes. And, you know, these are amongst those who have social media. There's some older people that are not indulging at this point. Older people... That's interesting. There's no real difference in age. Is there a difference in voting intention? Not really. Labor voters, slightly more positive. Don't quite know why. Independent other parties, more than slightly more negative. I think the whole idea that social media was this thing that would connect us and make us happy isn't being borne out. Whether you're a young person trying to find meaning in the noise of likes or an older person trying to find facts in a sea of rubbish, I'm not sure it's quite delivering on its promise.
And although positive and negative impact were close, if you ask it in a slightly different way about whether or not social media companies like Meta and TikTok should be regulated more, you find suddenly people are a bit more interventionist and want it to improve.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So there is a real thirst for regulation, 57% to 9% opposed, saying they should be regulated less, 34% saying the current regulation is about right, much higher there on age, so 77% of over 55s and just 36% of under 34s would like to see social media regulated more. Independent other parties, 65% the strongest supporter, but across the partisan divide, people want to see more regulation. And I think that also bears out some of the research we've done on AI regulation as well, where the appetite from the public for regulation is far stronger than it seems to be from the key decision makers, who tend to see it more as a positive than a risk. And on that, you know, there is support for the TikTok ban in Australia, although it's not overwhelming because there's a high number that are in the middle, but 45% all up support calls for the Australian government to pass laws that would ban the use of TikTok unless the parent company sold to another company, which is a proposition that's gone through in the US and James Patterson has been calling for in Australia. Just 25% opposing that. Again, they will be the kids. That's a massive difference. So 18 to 34s, it's 45% oppose and just 26% support, whereas us old fuddy-duddies, it's in the 60s support and just 11% oppose. So a real inversion in age or some like to call it experience.
And there was another specific form of regulation you put to people. You asked a news media bargaining code themed question and respondents were told that Meta, the artist formerly known as Facebook, recently announced it will close its news tab and stop paying media companies to access their journalism. Did people side with the media companies or with Meta in this developing stoush?
I think they're caught in the middle. So the majority here were neither or unsure, 47%, 33%, except the media company's argument that their content benefits Meta and this decision means journalists' jobs will no longer be funded, undermining democracy, 20% accepted the Meta argument that it doesn't share news, its users don't share news content and shouldn't have to pay media companies to access their journalism anymore. But let's be honest, Paul, this will be a fight between two big, powerful industries, big media and big tech. We've seen this movie before. It was played out, I think it was 2021 at the time. And people might remember Facebook pulled news for a short period of time as they were trying to push back on what's called the News Media Bargaining Code, which was part of the package of reforms that was called the Digital Platforms Inquiry, that was a big ACCC report that was looking at the sort of regulation that people want to see. And this was part of that. At the time, the government created an accommodation that allowed both Google and Facebook to hand money over to the media companies without actually being subject to the law. So it was kind of a fig leaf move. Since then, other countries have picked up this model as well. We don't know how much is involved because it is all commercial in confidence, but the accepted wisdom is it's several hundred million dollars a year going from the platforms who also don't pay much tax into media companies to, well, in the Guardian's case, employ journalism. We don't know how other media companies use it. So since then, there has been a number of other countries that have adopted these sorts of models, and Meta's basically said, we've had enough. In Canada, they've basically taken all the news off their platform. One argument would be at least that's honest, because if there's no news on Meta, then it can't pretend to be, you know, a platform that's presenting anything other than cute cats and conspiracy theories. But it will leave a massive hole in the balance sheets of all Australian media companies. And it's going to be played out. And obviously, we know the way the media covers stories about the media as a major piece of the public debate, I think, over the next 6 months. And I think, in a way, the public will be a bystander to this, because it's really going to be some of the largest corporations on earth versus the Australian media that also has a degree of power and influence, particularly in certain parts of Surry Hills.
But in the end, it's the voters that matter. So thank you for asking them what they thought of it all. Now, I think I might have to go and do some of my own research myself. So I'm going to let you cook and say thank you for joining us this week, Peter.
Bon appetit.
The executive producer of Australian Politics is Miles Martignoni. I'm Paul Karp. We'll have another episode of Australian Politics for you on Saturday. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.